it's interesting now working with a lot of people who've been through trauma. They are all on that journey, and it is a journey. There's ups and downs, and you move back a step and move forward a step. But there doesn't seem to be many middle ground people. Like, either it breaks you or it ends up making you. It's post-traumatic stress or post-traumatic growth, you know, and that suggests that there is kind of a decisive decision that people make to go right or left. Not, okay, I'm just going to sit in the middle here and kind of keep coasting.
Ed and Lois Jackson are my next guests on Conversations of Inspiration. This beautiful, gorgeous couple, and they had everything, thriving sports careers and the world at their feet, until Ed had a near fatal accident that rendered him paralyzed. And basically, their life that they knew changed overnight. And this story, this conversation is about a journey with unimaginable hardships and moments so hard to imagine, let alone go through. And it's a story where we again hit on resilience and love and hope and optimism to try and find a path out of the darkest of times. And I know that when speaking with them both, I could literally feel their strength, and you're going to feel it, and their love for each other. And it's a really beautiful love story as much as anything else. It's left me feeling uplifted. It's left me feeling like it was a masterclass of reframing struggles and perspective and how to help not only ourselves, but others too. And it's a conversation that is, I think, I don't know, the best of humanity. It just shows us what we as the humble human is actually capable of. Enjoy.
Bow your head and let your eyelids close on down. Where we're going, you won't need to bring your frown.
Hi, I'm Holly Tucker, and welcome to my podcast, Conversations of Inspiration. I've reached out to founders and those who simply inspire me to share their hard-earned wisdom with you. My hope is that collectively, these remarkable realizations will help you on your own journey. I like to think of it as inspiration for life. So let's begin this week's conversation of inspiration. Hello, both of you. A warm welcome to Conversations of Inspiration. Lovely to have you both here.
Thank you for having us. It's great to be
here. Yeah, our pleasure. Great to meet you, Holly.
Well, we are in epic stories. Listeners don't know what we're going to talk about yet, but I wanted to ask how life has been recently, because I did a little bit of good stalking and I saw that you recently had a trip to Morocco, and that's just one of my favorite places on the planet. I mean, it can be a bit overwhelming, can't it? Everything coming at you, but then I make up for it with the shopping. How was it for you?
Yeah, well, this time it was actually quite chill, but it was probably our third trip to Morocco. And the other times we've always been to the mountains. So we climbed Mount Toubkal, but this was a proper chill out. And after quite a hectic year, it was really what we needed. It was so nice to just relax.
Well, it was the first part of it wasn't that chilled. It was our friend's wedding. That was the reason we went over there. And that was a lot of fun involved, but we decided we'd need 5 days to recover off the back of it, which was a good decision.
Yeah, I can imagine. I've actually never done the relaxing bit of, well, also hiking up a mountain is hardly relaxing. But I've yet to go to the mountains. I've always been in the hustle and bustle, but I've heard the mountains are absolutely stunning.
Yeah, they're well worth a visit. I mean, it's only a couple of hours from Marrakesh into the Atlas Mountains, so you can do it in a day trip. But like, even the culture kind of shifts as well, because you're right into the Berber people up there, and it's fascinating and beautiful. And you can't believe as well, having been in sort of what is effectively the desert 2 hours away, it's lush and green and there's waterfalls, and yeah, I'd highly recommend it.
Oh, I'm booking. And I know, despite your joint love of adventure and pushing boundaries of life, you're quite homebodies, and you love sort of nothing else but getting out for nice long walks with Barry the bulldog and a pub lunch and things like that. Am I right in saying you live near Bath?
Yeah, we do, just outside, 20 minutes, and like look out into beautiful fields. And yeah, we do love going for long walks. Barry the Bulldog is now 11 and rather overweight, so he can't actually join us on any of them.
Have you become one of the couples with the push along? You know, the push along. I'm thinking, because my Mudley's 11 as well, and I'm thinking, I think I'm going to be eccentric dog lady with the push along buggy with the panting dog in it.
Yes, we have tried it, but it didn't go down that well. We put him on this like trailer thing, and he was chilled for the first 5-10 minutes, and then he just had enough, and he was just like barking and making some weird noise to get out. So we didn't try it again. He's actually just so happy chilling on the sofa and not leaving the house.
Yeah, I think the first part of his life, obviously, a lot of people get bulldogs because they want a dog that doesn't necessarily asked to move much, which but when we first got him, I was living in Cardiff and we were playing rugby, and every day off I'd take him up into the Brecon Beacons and take him up all of the big hills and stuff. So he was flogged when he was younger, but that's probably why he's quite a healthy 11-year-old bulldog, to be honest. But I think he's deserved his retirement and he's fully embracing it.
Yeah. Just being fed on the sofa. Why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you? And also, you're a bulldog. That's what's meant to happen. And I know it's just a bit of a cliche, but these things are, I don't know, the most precious things, aren't they? The most simple things in life. And I know, Ed, that brings me to your story and a terrible accident that happened. And I'm wondering if you might briefly share what happened, just an overview for those listening who might not know about it.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously, it's a very long, drawn-out story that's ongoing to this day. But in brief, my former life was a professional rugby player. I did that for 10 years, very fortunate to do that. And then I was recovering from a shoulder operation from rugby, and I went round to a family friend's house and effectively misjudged the depth of their swimming pool and hit my head very hard on the bottom, which meant I dislocated the bottom of my neck, had a very serious neck break, but also a spinal cord injury as a result of that. I was then resuscitated a few times. So it was, you know, very close to not being here at all, to be honest, but went to hospital, 7-hour operation, and woke up completely paralyzed from the shoulders down. And since that day to what I'm doing now, it's been a long journey, but one that, you know, I feel very fortunate to be in the position I am now. Even though I do have a disability and I live with the day-to-day, you know, challenges that I face with my particular circumstances, because everyone's disabilities and injuries are different, I feel very grateful to have made it as far as I could, because it should have been a very different story, really.
It's just incredible, isn't it, to think the whole life just could have changed, you know, in a blink of an eye. Everything you thought you knew, because you were young as well, you know, everything you thought you knew, your career, your physical, your mental health, your relationship, just shifted in a moment. And it is quite a, you know, for everyone listening, anything can happen. And it's quite a humbling experience, I'm sure. And I can't imagine, by the way, what both of you have been through. And that's what this podcast is about, and your story. But to understand a little bit more about that and the journey, I'd love to just take you back, though, to start with. You met at a fancy dress party, and you both attended Millfield, a school famous for sports. So, Lois, you were a netball extraordinaire, and Ed, you were initially in Milford on a swimming scholarship before you then turned to rugby. To start with, do you remember what you were wearing at the fancy dress party?
Yes, I was dressed as a ballerina, and Ed was dressed as a fireman, which is rather nice.
The theme was what you want to be when you're older, and I'd always wanted to, I was obsessed with fire trucks and everything as a kid, so and it was also quite a simple fancy dress compared to an astronaut or something like that.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. So what was your time like at Millfield?
So we never actually met at Millfield, because I only went for sixth form. So by the time I arrived, Ed had left because he was 2 years above me, which I would say was a bit of a blessing, because I don't think, you know, I think there was a timing thing involved with us getting together. I came from a state school and I got a netball scholarship. So it just completely blew my mind. I had no idea that schools existed like that. So to turn up and see all of the facilities, the cafeteria, like the dining hall, it was just amazing. And I made some lifelong friends. So yeah, absolutely loved it. You were there a bit longer though, weren't you, Ed?
Yeah, I joined in 13, as he said, on a swimming scholarship, and then it only took me a few weeks to realise I took swimming far too seriously, getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning, having to, you know, like three out of the four, like Olympic relay team for like the men's 4x2 were from, that won gold in Paris, were from Millfield. So it gives you, it gives you like an example of how soon. And I was at 14
years old. They weren't messing around.
No, getting up at 5 a.m. I was like, oh God, sod this. And then that's when I started playing rugby, really. So, I mean, it was an amazing experience, I think, really formative looking back at it. And you take things like that for granted a little bit at the time, but I've obviously been back to the school since, and you walk around and you're just like, this is ridiculous, really, in terms of the facilities. But more than that, it was like entering a boys' boarding house at 13 years old was probably that a lot of growing up had to be done very quickly. I was a bit of a mummy's boy before and, you know, very sheltered, if you like. And then all of a sudden, you're the youngest and smallest of 90 boys and half of them are trying to, you know, beat you up effectively most of the time. So you learn to either talk or hide, talk your way out of things or hide your way out of things pretty quickly. But it was a very formative part of both our developments, I think, but maybe for different reasons.
And I can just imagine, I mean, you're both very, very pretty and you're sporty. I mean, these two things that really shouldn't go together. I used to hate people like that at school. You know, I was when they choose the teams, I would be the last person that anyone would pick. I would be the thing that you didn't want to pick in your team. Yeah. So I'm picturing you both and you're a match made in heaven. After leaving school though, did you carry on with netball, Lois? And you headed to uni, didn't you? And you netball coaching and at quite a high level. And Ed, you went straight to a rugby professional career as well. Tell me about your lives, and it must have been very exciting. I mean, there you were, both of you pursuing this sort of level of sports, and you've got this bond and you've got fitness and you've got life. What was it like?
It was amazing, to be fair. Like, netball was my world. I grew up, my mum was a netball coach. I managed to get into the England under 16s, under 18s.
Wow.
And I was playing Team Bath when I was 18, so the Super League team there. So it was a whirlwind. I remember there was a lot of pressure, like, early on, you know. I think you enjoy it and you go through the motions with it. But I do remember, you know, you're trying to get into the team. There's, like, constant pushing yourself, but I learned so much about who I was and about where I wanted to go. And I think actually, if I look back, it probably did have a lot to do with why Ed and I got on so well. Like, I was 18 and he was 21 when we first met at that fancy dress party, and we had an instant bond about being sporty, you know, going to play tennis together or going to chuck a ball around. It was just something that we absolutely loved doing.
Yeah, I completely agree with Lois. It becomes your entire identity. And as you pointed out, like, especially at a school like Millfield, sport is good social currency, because I was really, when I went there, I was quite a shy, reserved kid and very nervous around people, but I had this thing that I was good at, which gave me some sort of social standing.
Your peacock feathers.
And so that brought me out of myself, you know. It gave me the confidence to sort of evolve into someone who is more confident, and actually it was through the lens of sport that I did that. And but then when you go professional, you very quickly go from a big fish in a small pond to a very small fish in a very big pond. And I mean very big in terms of the fish around you are a lot bigger as well, because all of a sudden you're playing with all of these massive men and reality hits. But, you know, it becomes a job, but you still love it and you feel very grateful for what you're doing. But as Lois said, there's a lot of pressure, and it's, people see the glorious side of sport, but also the other side is injuries, contracts, having to move around the country all the time. There is a stressful side of it as well, which I'm very much on the front line of now as a trustee of Restart, looking after all of the professional players in the UK. And there's big mental health issues in there as well. Having said all of that, I love that I managed to do that, or had the opportunity to do that for 10 years. I think that the emotional tools it gave me, probably around things like work ethic, resilience, you know, tempering emotions, not getting too carried away with the highs, but not letting the lows beat you down, because it is a roller coaster. One week you win, one week you lose, one week you're injured, one week you're not, has set me good stead in later life. But rugby is a very physical sport. So me personally, obviously, I have medical issues along with my spinal cord injury, which are quite obvious, but also, you know, I've got no cartilage in my knee. I've had seven operations by the age of 27. And in reality, we do not get paid like footballers. So yeah, it's not something you can retire on. So there are implications to it, you know, and I think it's important to make people realize, you know, sport's amazing. And I think I would advise anyone to get involved in sport at a young age, but also understand what it means to commit your life to something like that. Mm-hmm. But I think Lois and I both identified as sports people. It was kind of the main points of our character. It was our social currency through school. So it's what you lean into. You yes. kind of cement your identity with your ability on a sporting pitch, which mm-hmm. of course is a very dangerous thing to do because of, as we all know, sport ends at a relatively young age, career wise. And when you lose that, if you've been so wrapped up in it from a young age, it feels like you lose your identity as well, yep. which is something obviously we both had to face at certain points in our lives.
Absolutely. And in 2016, we're going to segue now into your story here, Ed. But in 2016, you proposed and you're planning your wedding for 2 years later in Tuscany, and life is good and everything was falling into place and you had a beautiful future ahead of you. And then one day in April 2017, everything changed. And I know that you touched on it earlier, Ed. It was an accident that you went through, but you remember everything because you didn't lose consciousness. As someone so in tune with their body, did you instinctively know how bad the damage was or could be?
That's a very good question, because I think deep down I knew that literally lying in the pool, I knew my rugby career was over, because I couldn't move anything. I realised it was really serious. I didn't at that point, allow myself to consider what this would mean for the rest of my life. You know, a few days later or even 24 hours later when I woke up in intensive care, or at least 7 days later in particular when I had no movement or sensation return and I was told I was never going to walk again. At that point, you know, in the pool, I definitely didn't consider that would be the case. I was like, all right, get me to hospital.
Yeah.
I've had plenty of operations in the past. They'll sort me out. But I think I knew deep down that my rugby career was over. I think really that the first time it came to the surface that I truly sort of absorbed the immensity of what was happening was when I saw Lois, because she was in Cardiff at the time.
She got a call from your stepmom. Mm.
Mm.
Not
yeah.
telling you really, Lois, is that right? The truth, to get you to the hospital.
Yeah. She was really good, actually. She didn't tell me too much, so I didn't panic. And I honestly thought that he would have just smacked his head and he might have needed stitches or something. But when I walked into A&E, it was so obvious, you know, I felt like I was in an episode of 24 Hours in mm-hmm. A&E, you know, when his head was strapped down with that red strap and there was just people rushing around him who's being injected with that adrenaline. And I just looked into his eyes and he looked so terrified. I think you're obviously trying to put on a brave face, but you realise that something is seriously wrong. And he just kept saying, sorry, I'm so sorry. And so I think by that point it kind of all came crashing down.
Why were you saying sorry, Ed?
I think I just knew that this would have repercussions on our life. I didn't mm-hmm. know what that would be. I just, you know, you're right. We were both lucky enough to be doing things that we loved for our careers. We had just got engaged. Like, everything was just going so well. And all of a sudden, a stupid mistake and everything gets blown out of the water. And it was that I just had an overwhelming feeling of guilt, not to what I'd, you know, done to myself, but what I'd done to everyone else around me and mostly and in particular Lois. I didn't appreciate at that time what that would mean, but I just knew in my soul that this wasn't good. And it was going to change things.
You basically, after this point, you had the devastating news that you were paralyzed from the neck down. And after surgery, you were told that it's very unlikely that you would ever walk again, and that the best you could hope for was that you might regain the use of your arms. How did you begin to process that information, you know, that life as you knew had changed, that your career, as you said, was extinguished, your upcoming marriage to Lois? It must have just been a very dark time. And I can't even imagine, you know, when we say process it, like, it's every day, every moment, mm. you're absorbing it and your family around you. But it must have been a monumental thing to get your head around.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and processing it was a journey that took probably years. Reality.
I can imagine.
In that moment, I mean, just to give it some context. So they do something called an ASIA test, which is the American Spinal Injury Assessment. Every morning they'll come in and they'll use electrodes and they'll use temperature checks and pinpricks to check your sensation and any movement or activation in your muscles. And they do that every 24 hours after you wake up. So when I was delivered that news, it was a week after I'd woken up in intensive care. And I'm not stupid. Like, I knew that they were getting no results below the level of my injury. So effectively where you get injured in your spinal cord depends on how much of your body is affected. So paraplegics right. are normally back breaks. That means their legs are affected, or where from whatever that level is down, mm-hmm. and quadriplegics are neck breaks. So whatever. And so my injury is C6 and C7. So that implied that if it was a complete injury, which they thought it was, judging by the ASIA results after 7 days, I still should be able to use my arms to a certain extent, yep. not all of my arms, not my hands, but the level of injury. But it meant I definitely wasn't going to be able to walk again, and I wouldn't have had core muscles, or so it would have been assisted living. I wouldn't have been independent. I wouldn't have been able to care for myself fully. And obviously the ramifications are you're not just affecting your life, you're affecting yes. everyone around you. And the processing element in that moment was quite a surprising one, because when I was told that news by the surgeon, I did have quite a strange reaction in that, yes, it was like getting winded. It was the worst thing I'd ever heard in my life, technically. However, I already knew that that was coming, because yeah. it wasn't like there were certain ASIA test results and some were good and some were bad and they were putting together a prognosis. Nothing had changed, and I knew that. So when he said that this is the case, it kind of drew a line in the sand, but it was that word independence that made me realize that it wasn't just about me anymore. It was about everyone that was going to have to look after me for the rest of my life. And that actually gave me a massive amount of motivation to take the attention off myself, stop just feeling sorry for myself, and start thinking about the other people that this would affect.
Did you know that as a nation, we're still spending $12.3 billion on Black Friday deals, despite the fact that 80% of that ends up in landfill, is incinerated, or is recycled poorly? And nearly 60% of the UK small businesses fear closure. We know Christmas is make or break for many UK independents. So a few years ago, we invented Colour Friday as a sustainable alternative to Black Friday, a way to sing from the rooftops about the colour and creativity that this remarkable collective brings to the UK. We want people to think about where they spend their hard-earned money this Christmas. And rather than sending CEOs to the moon, isn't it better to plug it back into our communities and the families that really need it? This year, we're asking you to support small businesses instead. They generate $1.6 trillion for the UK economy, employ 16 million people, and bring colour to our lives, not to mention our shopping. So for unique Christmas gifts, thoughtfully made decorations, and more, support Colour Friday. Shop with an independent business on the 29th of November. Visit holly.co also to find out more. And now we're going back to our conversation of inspiration. Lois, I read that Ed said that you should leave him and that you didn't sign up for this and that you were, you know, only 25 at the time. And it must have been so much for you to deal with and to see him like that in hospital, so vulnerable and so at odds with, you must have had everything that was going through his mind going through your mind, and the sort of juxtaposition of it all, you know, loving someone, about to marry them, but hang on a minute, I don't know if this was what my whole life was meant to look like.
Yeah, totally. And it's weird looking back, because I mean, of course, straight away, I just told him to shut up and that I wasn't going to be leaving him and he was stuck with me no matter what. And I think I honestly just kicked into adrenaline mode. There was a few moments, and that was mainly when I was driving on my own to and from the hospital, that I did have like breakdown. But to be honest, like in front of each other, we just tried to be really strong. We used a lot of humour to try and get us through each day without knowing it, because I've gone on to do a life coaching qualification now. But we were using a lot of the life coaching methods in terms of just doing small steps, focusing on what he could do each day, not thinking too big. Obviously, we knew the goal was to try and walk again, but we would never talk about that, you know, on a day-to-day basis. One of the weirdest things that happened to me, so literally the time when he was in A&E and we got told about the MRI results that it was a spinal cord injury, I was in the waiting room with his stepmom and I burst into tears and said, "I want his babies." Which, if anybody knows me, I am the least maternal person out there. And like, we hadn't even really spoken about having babies. I think obviously that was maybe our path, but it was, you know, I think I just thought that was affected when you have a spinal cord injury, and that I wanted to be with him for the rest of our lives, and that might be affected. And so I did question things, but pretty good, both of us, at putting ourselves together and putting on a strong face, definitely for that time in hospital. And I think then the vulnerabilities and the efforts in communication came a bit later when he had come out of hospital and things were starting to improve and get better. But then along with that comes the change of your life doesn't look like it did before. When you're in hospital, you're in a bubble, right?
Yes.
You don't really compare yourself to what had happened before, what was normal in real life. And then suddenly when you are faced with that, it kind of hits a little bit harder.
From reading your story and even more so now from hearing you both speak, you know, your positivity has just played a massive role. And I know, Ed, you took a glimmer of hope from the phrase "unlikely to ever walk again" and thought that there might just be this tiny, tiny chance that the unlikely part gave you this glimmer of hope, and it helped with the help of your medical team and Lois and this whatever it is, the training in you, you were determined and you slowly progressed to a wheelchair and then to stand again and then to walk with a crutch and then a special device I read to help you actually lift your foot. Tell me about the motivation, about what that took, what that journey was, because I can only imagine on bad days, you know, you must be thinking, this is just never going to happen. And what am I doing?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, so just to set the scene a little bit, in terms of my test results, so I was ASIA A1. So if anyone's listening who understands spinal cord injury, they'll know what that means. It means complete injury, but that's just based on your test results. So what actually happened is spinal shock that normally only lasts 24 or 48 hours ended up, because my trauma was so bad, lasting for 9 days. So you can't out-train a severed spinal cord or a genuinely complete injury. Yep. They were right to tell me it was complete at the time because that was based on my test results, but fortunately it wasn't. So that gave me something to work with. Having said that, if I hadn't had the motivation of like doing this for Lois or my mum, and spending every waking moment trying to wiggle something, just staring at your toes and trying to move something, then it probably wouldn't have happened at that nine-day mark. So I was just, but from that point, from when my toe wiggled, I was like, right, all bets are off. You know, it's like, let's just see how far we can take this, because obviously there is a connection past the level of my cord.
That must have been, can you just stop on that moment? Like that moment must have been, just the fact it moved meant that the diagnosis was different, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Gosh.
I said before, but it's amazing that like a wiggling toe becomes the biggest moment of your life. Yeah. Like when you've spent time like running out at international stadiums and like all of this sort of stuff and all of a sudden your toe wiggles and you feel a rush of adrenaline and excitement like nothing you've ever felt before. And it was obviously an amazing moment. And at first I thought it was just a spasm because I was getting spasms, and then I realized it was moving when I was telling it to. And then I was like, "Mum, get in here. You need to see what's going on." on. And then obviously I didn't want to stop wiggling it because I thought it would never come back again. But that wiggling toe over time, you know, evolved and developed into more movement. But still at that point, I was just hoping to be independent. So I was still thinking I'm going to be in a wheelchair most likely, but at least if I do everything I can to get as far as I can, then I'll be able to look Lois in the face or even myself in the mirror when she is having to look after me or whatever it might be and know that it was out of my hands and that's okay. But I didn't want it to be through lack of effort that this affected our life in any negative way. But still, because of that, there was uncertainty all the way through that period. So I was still having to deal, like you said, sometimes it stagnates, like sometimes you even go the other way. And half of the battle was staying in a positive mindset, not actually just doing the physical work. And it was developing the tools to try and keep positive. And a lot of that came through measuring the progress, like Lois alluded to earlier, focusing on small goals. So instead of thinking we're going to walk again and just getting frustrated because it seems like it's never happening, thinking I'm just going to try and move the third finger on my right hand a little bit more today. And you'd do that and you'd achieve it and you'd feel good about it and you'd set a challenge for the next day. So we were kind of evolving these processes and understandings. And like Lois said, just completely naturally, like we had no background in sort of any of that sort of personal development, life coaching, psychology, philosophy element. But then since, obviously, as we have and moved into the charity and passing it on to our beneficiaries, we've realized that all of the things that we were evolving naturally and those defense mechanisms that the human brain is so good at doing are all researched and standard practice for people who are implementing them with others. But it was just interesting to see those things evolve. But it was tough. It was really hard, and especially in the times where there weren't people there. So like Lois said, when she's driving home, I just was, at night for me, my thought processes were going really dark. Like our brain has a negativity bias, and obviously with so much uncertainty for about the future, you know, rugby was gone. That was the only thing I ever knew. What was this going to mean for the rest of our lives? Not just can I walk again, but jobs, you know, were we going to get married? Like all of this sort of stuff means that you're in a really dark mental space. So I leaned heavily on my support network, and I feel very, very grateful to have a strong one in terms of Lois, obviously, but my family and friends. And spending a lot of time on a spinal ward, you realize that not everyone has that. You just take those things for granted. And it's something I'll never take for granted again, that's for sure.
I mean, talking of that, one of my guests was Henry Fraser, the mouth artist, and who was paralyzed after an accident. And like you said, you know, he has a world that has now meant that he has had huge challenges. But actually, when we were speaking, it was about facing into it and how he easily could have become the victim and succumbed to that dark mental space. And he too had an amazing and has an amazing network around him. And I know you wrote about this side of things in your book called Lucky. Is that what you ultimately feel? Do you feel that you are lucky?
It's an interesting question, because the word luck is something that I've been trying to unpick for a long time now, and I'm actually potentially writing a second book about it, and what are the traits of lucky people and how do you become luckier. But of course I was lucky that I didn't have a complete spinal cord injury. Of course I was, you know, but I was also unlucky that I dived in the wrong end of the pool. So which one is it? And you choose to focus on the positives, because the only other option is to focus on the negatives, and the negatives are everywhere. And that is when you turn away from the issue, because we can't affect what's happened to us. It's already happened, and life chucks challenges at us all the time. All we can affect is how we respond to those challenges. And I completely agree with Henry. Like, you get to this point, you have these turning points. Mine was being when the surgeon came in and said, you know, you're probably never going to walk again. We're hoping you can use your arms again to be independent. And you kind of have a decision to make. It's like, right, which way am I going to go? Am I going to try and make the most of everything and face into this challenge? And if for want of a better term, embrace it. But it's not a flick of a switch. It's not like, okay, I'm just going to be about positive everything. Yeah, I'm just going to be positive about everything now. You know, it's a lot more to that. It's a journey that you go on. But the other option is to bury your head in the sand, ignore it, and then, you know, you're not gonna get to where you might want to be, or at least you're not gonna fulfill your potential within the scope of your own injury. So there are those poignant moments along the path where it's like you have a decision to make and you've got to go one way or the other. And it's interesting now, working with a lot of people who have been through trauma, they are all on that journey, and it is a journey. There's ups and downs, and you move back a step and move forward a step. But there doesn't seem to be many middle ground people. Like, either it breaks you or it ends up making you. It's post-traumatic stress or post-traumatic growth, you know, and that suggests that there is kind of a decisive decision that people make to go right or left. Not, okay, I'm just going to sit in the middle here and kind of keep coasting.
And there were other challenges, weren't there, Lewis? I know that you've been very open and honest about how it changed things between the two of you, your physical relationship, and the fact that you were dealing with things that you just couldn't have foreseen. How did you deal with those pressures? Because it feels like you were both, you know, you decided that you were going to travel a certain route, and that was on the more positive side. But as Ed alluded to, and as you said, there's these car journeys, these moments, these things. And then there's the actual reality. Now you're out of the hospital. It's day-to-day life. It's, you know, you've got to go and get the milk. And what happened to you?
Yeah. And I think Ed fully threw himself into his recovery journey. And I 100% did as well when he was in hospital. And obviously then when he came out, it was back to work. You know, we moved in with Ed's dad just outside Bath for about 6 months in the end. I'd left my job over in Wales and I'd got a new one in Bath. So it was very much back to normal. But Ed was on this different trajectory. He was like aiming to climb his first mountain and pay back money to Restart Rugby, who'd given him so much fundraising. And then as we kind of settled into it, probably post our wedding, I just realised that the connection between us just wasn't quite right. And to be honest, at the time, I probably didn't even have a clue what was going on, that I was probably dealing with the trauma at a later stage, now that I look back. And it was weird for me because when we would kiss or cuddle, he would smell different. Now, that was like one of the biggest things that I found really strange.
I thought you'd be happy about that. He was...
True.
Well, yeah. From rugby boy. Muddy stink.
You were still mountain boy, so it was the same. But yeah, and I almost felt like I was cheating on Ed because it was like you don't realise that how many senses are wrapped up when you do love somebody. And yeah, we'd been through a lot and we probably hadn't faced what we'd been through together as a couple. I just realised that if I didn't communicate how I was feeling to Ed at that time, then I would just withdraw more and more. And I think this can happen quite a lot of relationships when something breaks down, right? You don't communicate it, then how's it going to get any better? And so, yeah, I was dealt with that decision and I decided to go and get help, actually. So I spoke to a relationship therapist and a sexual therapist and normalized everything that I was feeling, which made me feel so much more relaxed. Because if you think, I had no one else to talk to. No one was going through a similar journey.
At the time?
25, yeah, 26 probably by the time we had that conversation, which, yeah, now you say that. It's so young, isn't it? And had that chat with Ed, which was pretty brutal in terms of, you know, you're telling the person that you love that something isn't quite right. And yeah, I mean, Ed will obviously say what he thought, but we managed to then start again and we were like, okay, so who are we as people? Like, we still love each other. We still want a future together. How does that look now? And then I actually did realize that I needed to focus more on my own journey and what I was doing, because I was completely immersed in Ed's life and like making him better, and everything was different and I didn't want the things that I wanted before. I wasn't the netball player. I was something completely different, and I was starting again and figuring all of that out. And then of course we went through our journey to setting up the charity and my life coaching, which kind of gave me that independence, and I could be then a better version of myself for Ed too. So it felt like a selfish decision at the beginning, but actually, you know, you look at it now and it was impacting both
and,
of us.
And can I ask, I mean, would you have classified yourself as a carer?
I mean, at the early stages, yes.
Because I can imagine this is something that many carers go through, that actually this all happened to Ed and this is the focus here. but actually your entire world changed as, not as much maybe physically, but your entire world just changed. But it's not about you. And yet, no. Actually, hang on a minute, I've just basically given away one life for another life, and yet it's not the done thing to talk about me at all. So, and actually, is it polite? Is this selfish that I should even be thinking of? Because of course it can't be worse than Ed.
Those were all my thoughts, yeah. And that made it even worse. It made you push them down even further, because you did feel ashamed and you did feel like your journey and opinion wasn't as bad as Ed's. So what are you complaining about, you know? And that's probably why you couldn't talk to other people about it. And I didn't know any other carers at the time that maybe I could have spoken about. But I mean, Ed was pretty good at recognising it as well. Like you really championed me to go and seek my own journey and put time into myself, which was amazingly selfless as well.
And I think this is great to be talking about it to anyone listening. There are many, you know, thousands of carers out there, so many people who potentially haven't got a voice, you know, to talk about the caring side of something. And it's amazing, actually, that this is part of this story as much as Ed's story, this care. And it must have been hard for you, Ed, to hear that as well, because one of the first things you said before thinking of yourself was sorry. It's like you knew the future Lois and what she might then go through.
Yeah. It was really hard to hear for a number of reasons. A, for that initial reason of the guilt of like, oh no, like, oh my God, I've put Lois in this situation where she's struggling. But then also because it was the lens through which we were talking about these issues was a direct sort of insecurity of mine, because being a bloke and being a rugby player, my identity was wrapped up in being my physicality, you know, and the lens was like Lois was like struggling, you know, on the sexual side as well, which isn't talked about enough because of the change and all of those things. So I was like, oh my God, you know, these are the things that I didn't want to have to face, because it's a direct sort of assault on my ego. So it was an amazing sort of process to realize the important thing here is Lois is okay. And it was hard to hear, but I was like, we need to work through this. And actually, I had been burying my head in rehab as a way of distracting myself from the realities of what this meant for the rest of our lives. And I was ignoring some of the most important things, which, you know, were Lois. And Lois was one of them. And I think that I wasn't consciously ignoring her. I thought everything was okay. And as Lois said, because of that guilt of feeling like you can't say you're struggling when you're a carer. And by carer, we don't necessarily mean, you know, full-time washing someone and looking after them. Of course, that plays into it. But anyone who cares for someone who has gone through trauma or gone through a struggle in their life, if you love that person, you are going to go through that trauma with them emotionally, and often worse than they are, because you feel helpless. Like, unequivocally, Lois would agree with this. Like, when we get contacted by people who have had bad injuries, you know, which happens reasonably regularly, it's never the individual going through it the worst. It'll be a mother or a husband or a son or something, someone within that close family network. And the first thing we tell them is like, it's okay for you to be struggling. Like, that is completely normal. And take time for yourself, speak to people, because as Lois rightly points out, the best version of the carer is the best thing that you can do as a carer for the person you're looking after. Throughout this whole process, I think one thing that I have, that one of the best things that's happened to me as a change is like the ability to be vulnerable and face up to the things that you don't automatically want to face up to. You're at your proper insecurities because there's something more at stake. And I've gone from seeing vulnerability and what I would have used to have called weakness, you know, like as a rugby player, as a young rugby player, you're taught, don't even let the other opposition know you're injured. And, you know, that spills over into the psychological side and is one of the big reasons we have a lot of mental health issues with young men. And especially in rugby, there's a bit of a pandemic at the moment. But for me, I had to go through that process. But I had to face up to the fact that I wasn't the person I was before. I did need looking after. I was in a position where Lois was struggling because of the differences within me. And it was like, no, you're not that person anymore. Let's draw a line in the sand and work out who this version of Ed is, and you had to let go of that person.
Dell Technologies are passionate champions of small businesses. They recognise that it can be a lonely road, and so they have the Dell Women's Entrepreneur Network, or DWEN for short, which is a worldwide community of over 100,000 female founders. They run free events and mentoring programmes and have a network of brilliant women all connecting and sharing insight. They also recognise that for many small businesses, visibility is one of the biggest challenges they face when trying to reach new customers. So each week, Dell give away their ad break space. So now I'm going to hand over to this week's winner of Dell's independent ad break.
I'm Georgina, the designer behind Whistling Thorn Designs, where we create luxurious, story-filled wallpapers that transform spaces and spark conversation. Having lived in Africa for most of my life, I was inspired to bring its vibrant colours, natural beauty and a touch of Victoriana into our homes. Every wallpaper has a story, crafted to spark joy and wonder, like our carousel safari inspired by my grandmother's Victorian rocking horse, or Kiri Miri featuring a cheeky, mirror-loving sunbird who was a regular visitor in our home. Whistling Thorn Designs isn't just wallpaper. It's a journey, a memory, an invitation to make your space feel like so much more than a home. It's a truly British brand inspired by the world. If you're curious, you can find us at www.whistlingthorn.co.uk.
Thank you, Dell, for your support and generosity. If you'd like to find out more about DWEN and connect with brilliant and inspiring women, or you'd like to be in with a chance to have your very own ad break here on this series, head to holly.co/Dell. Now, back to this week's conversation of inspiration. When we think about the absolute crisis that we're in with men and their mental health, and the statistic escapes me right now, but it's something like the number one or number two killer of
number one in men under 40 suicide.
Men under 40s is suicide. I mean, how are we in this space? And potentially, you think maybe moving on in time, masculinity would have sort of calmed down because we're not sort of in caves and fighting off mammoths, and that was a really long time ago, and you know, we're moving for, what do you think, and we're going to go into the story of now creating your charity and things, but just taking a sort of moment in a bubble, what do you think's going on?
I think that the hardware of our body is our, you know, is our brain, and with our phones, for example, there's software updates as we go through life, and as life changes around us, you make new software, but that we're still basically walking around with 200,000-year-old software in our male brains and our female brains as well. And as society shifts and shakes, and you know, there's more exposure to what it's supposed to mean to be a man, and it's a very hard thing to navigate at the moment. And especially you're being told one thing and then being asked to do another thing. And there's certain elements of masculinity which definitely are toxic if they're put in a certain way, but there's also certain elements of masculinity that should be embraced and tried to be used in a positive way as well. And it's trying to strike that balance between the two, but you can't help but feel the way you do with your urges often as a man or a woman, because I think they're hardwired into you, but it's what you do with those, whether it's at your testosterone causing anger, or, you know, that used to come out on a rugby pitch, you know, but now it's like, how can you channel that in a positive way to be driven towards something? And I think it's really needed at the moment to reframe and go, it's okay to feel these things because it's completely natural, because we still have that software of cavemen, and we still feel like we need to go out and kill mammoths and things like that, but that's just not possible in everyday life. But how can we channel that in a positive way, not just for ourselves, but for our partners, you know, for everyone else around
us? Gosh, it affects everyone. It's a really needed thing to talk about men and the challenges that they are facing at the moment. Good men and the challenges that they're facing on who they're meant to show up as, on what given day, what given news agenda. You know, it's a very complicated time. I'm very glad to say that in the end, in 2018, you had your wedding under the Tuscan sun as planned. Lois, was that a magical day?
It was beautiful, yeah. I mean, I had the best time. Ed might have had an overheating issue because it was about 40 degrees in the Tuscan hills with no breeze. And because of Ed's spinal cord injury, he can't sweat below the nipples. So, yeah, he nearly fainted as the celebrant was doing her thing. So we sped that up and then got down to party by the pool. But yeah, to be honest, it was such an incredible time because it was just after a year after his accident. So we could have all of our family and friends there to celebrate Ed walking back down the aisle and say thank you, really, because, yeah, like we've said, they went through it with us too. Like, I literally had to create a rota because he had so many people coming to visit him in hospital. So, yeah, it was a really nice opportunity to repay those thanks.
Yeah, yeah. And I could imagine just everyone just looking at you walking back down the aisle and what a moment, one year later. And your recovery has been, as we've mentioned this word journey, and it certainly has been for you, and built on this willpower, this determination. And I know then an urge, and we talked about this whole thing about life coaching and that you were using these tools but you were inspiring other, you were facing these challenges in a certain way. And in 2018, just after this accident, after you got married, you decided to set up your new target to climb Snowdon and, you know, spark something in you. You decided to climb mountains, which is just, you know, who would have thought, really, actually? Who would have thought that that was the thing that got you in Wales, Nepal, in the Alps? What did your family think? What did Lois think about mountains and undertaking huge challenges? And was this therapeutic for you? Because it must have been physically ridiculous for you as well.
Yeah, I suppose the way that I present now, in terms of the left side of my body not really working, I can't really lift my leg off the floor. I have temperature regulation issues, like Lois said, weakness in my core, bladder, bowel, all of these issues, that they are not conducive to climbing mountains. I probably could have picked something. Like, I'm much better in water than I am on land, so I should have gone back to swimming or something.
Yes.
But I think that originally it was the metaphor of that was the reason I wanted to do it. And the reason I chose to go up Snowdon, you know, at that point as a challenge was to try and inspire my friends in hospital that I'd spent months with that maybe the prognosis they were given didn't have to be the outcome, or at least go and find out for yourself. Because I was given one prognosis, the outcome was different. Now, the caveat to that is it might be the outcome. You know, like I said, you can't out-train a complete injury, but I just wanted to give some hope to some people to hold on to try and keep wiggling, for want of a better term. Mm-hmm. I also wanted to raise money for Restart, who had supported me. And that what happened on that journey up Snowdon was I opened it up on social media to anyone who wanted to come and join in, thinking three or four people might turn up. 70 people came, which was mind-blowing. And we, you know, it was one of the hardest things I'd ever done in my life at the time, obviously because of my condition, but also I spent this amazing time talking to other people and hearing about what they were going through and why they were there and just seeing the best side of human nature. But more than that, seeing some good coming from what I'd mm-hmm. only seen as a bad thing up until that point. And with that came a sense of purpose. Mm-hmm. And I thought I was never going to feel that again since rugby left me. And obviously that then evolved, and obviously I wanted to go higher and further, and, you know, now done some pretty crazy mountains, which I'd never anticipated I'd do even before my accident, even if I had a fully functioning body, but also the charity off the back of that. And yes, it was a massive healing process for me, psychologically and physically, being in those big environments, challenging my body, giving me something to aim for so I could carry on doing the rehab. It's been really formative.
And Lois, did you do these climbs as well?
I did Snowdon, and then Ed did his first big trip to Nepal to climb Mirror Peak, which I didn't go on. I was well into my netball job at that point. And I remember he came back from that trip and a special trip to the Alps when he climbed Mont Buet. And he was like, Lois, like, you've got to come to the mountains. It's amazing. Like, it makes you feel so good. Like, really trying to convince me. And I grew up in Bournemouth. So I've always been a beach gal. And so I was like, no, like, I just want to go to the beach. beach. And then now, yeah, now I'm pretty
well, the
obsessed.
First questions were, what are the sleeping arrangements?
Yes.
Do I have to go to the toilet in a hole?
Like, yes.
Yeah.
Agree.
Know, which is completely understandable.
Yeah, camping. Yes.
Yeah.
I'm with you, although you've now converted. I'm totally
not fully.
Sure.
I'm still not there with the camping.
Oh, good.
And actually, there's lots of mountain trips that you can do where you stay in some
oh,
nice
really?
Nice huts.
Okay, I need to talk to you about those. But looking at this whole thing and this love affair of mountains, The Mountain Within Me is a documentary that was released this year, filmed amongst the most spectacular of scenery, breathtaking, and a message of overcoming adversity and using kindness and compassion and positivity and community. I mean, what a beautiful film. I mean, who would have thought this? You know, this is this unbelievable path that you're taking, that a film is now being created. What do you hope that people are going to take from this film?
I mean, yeah, it's madness. Like, I still can't believe it's happened, but even though we were sort of 3 years making the film, the feedback has been so not reassuring, I suppose reassuring, because the reason when we first met the director, Polly Steele, the reason we made the film, the reason, because it was a nerve-wracking experience handing over your life to someone to put out there and to potentially get mass exposure, especially considering who was making it in Universal Studios. It's like, oh, wow, this could, you know, it's not just people, it's not just my story, it's Lois's story, it's our family's stories, our beneficiary stories are in there as well. The aim of the film was, if this can change someone's path, even if it's just one person, like if they can take something valuable away from this that actually changes the course of their life or has a positive impact on their life, not just a piece of entertainment that they enjoy for an hour and a half, but the messaging comes across, then we should do it. And that's the way we should make it. And it's been amazing to have the feedback that that has happened. Like, the amount of amazing, incredible messages we've received about how it's helped people is really powerful and completely humbling. Still tough to get a head around that it exists. You know, it's now on Amazon Prime and everything. So it's out there for the world to see, our full lives. But I'm really glad we did it. And I'm really glad we did it with the people we did, because Polly, George, Universal did an amazing job.
It's just, I mean, just amazing. And for everyone, you must watch it. And you'll need tissues as well. That's all I can say. Lois, you co-founded a charity together from this journey called Millimeters to Mountains. I mean, what a great name, by the way. A mental health charity that through the great outdoors, which is now your passion as well, and the power of community, you can inspire and support people basically redefining their limitations and looking at their futures, that brighter futures. And you trained as a life coach nearly, is it 5 years ago? Tell me about what that has been like, creating this charity, and about the M2M program.
I still can't believe that, to be honest. Like, back in 2019, actually, it was Ed and Ollie, our friend, who set it up as a non-profit. And then when I left my netball job, I started taking it on and we changed it into a charity. And the whole premise behind it was, we realised how lucky we were to have that support system. And I think we did compare ourselves to the people that were in hospital that didn't have that. And they didn't try and get better, you know, they had nothing to get better for. So we wanted to create something that gave that support system to others that were going through trauma. And that's physical or mental trauma. So we take on 8 beneficiaries a year who have had some kind of incident happen in their lives that's thrown them off course. And then we'll put a development program around them. So for 3 years as well, where they get life coaching, grants for extra therapy, physiotherapy. We host events such as like a wellness weekend where we'll do lots of holistic practices and also take them on a global adventure. So we'll plan 3 or 4 trips a year to the Alps, to Nepal, to Kyrgyzstan, to Albania we've done, and really make them realize how capable they really are. It's kind of mimicking Ed's journey, right?
Yeah.
So what did we have in place? And then, yeah, what can we give others so that they have that similar journey and basically get the tools to be able to handle when things don't go quite right again, because life is full of problems, right? You're never not going to have any problems, but it's how you deal with it, like Ed said. So can we give them those mindset tools, and also using nature as such a healer? And also the biggest byproduct that we didn't realize, I don't think, when we set it up, was the community side of things, because actually the beneficiaries heal each other. So Ed and I are kind of guiding the whole thing, but their chats are so, so important. And they, even though their traumas can be different, they can still connect about what they've gone through and feel like that they have people there for them. So it's so lovely watching them become like mates outside of the program, and really supporting each other. And like it says in the film, right, helping others helps you massively. So they're learning that as well. Like, so many of the beneficiaries that we've had through the program have now gone out the other side, and they're setting up their own charities or their own like community groups, because they've realized that there is so much power in that. So I'm hoping, even though we take on only 8 beneficiaries, the ripple effects of those beneficiaries going through that will be huge.
Well, it sounds like it. And can you tell me, can anyone get involved? Because it's a gorgeous website, by the way. I was looking at it, and you can take part, can't you, in fundraising, but also volunteering. And I saw on your site that you run UK walks as much as like bigger global challenges.
Yeah, so we set up the Together Outdoors program as well, because we realised that there's a lot of people that maybe have gone through what you call like little T trauma, who would love to just go and walk and talk locally. And we have a life coach and a team leader on every walk. So you can just come along. We normally do some kind of like wellness element to it as well. And we're going to be really pushing those out in 2025. So making it a bit more localized, so there'll be more walks to join in on. And yeah, we're always looking for people to come and help out and become a team leader. If anybody's got any skills in mountain leading or life coaching, then yeah, please get in touch.
I mean, it's just, and Ed, is it just amazing that you now both have found you're not only partners in life, but partners in work as well? That must have been, again, another surprise on this interesting adventure that you're on.
Yeah, I mean, it is incredible. And they always say sort of don't work with friends or family. But, you know, I can say that actually it's been an incredibly positive experience, considering we both have this shared mission. And I think that we thought our identity was in sport. And for a while it was, but really there is no such thing as an identity. It's like, what are you doing and what are you passionate about? And I couldn't have felt more aligned in terms of purpose now. And that I'm doing things, or we're doing things, that we would never have done if it wasn't for me diving in the wrong end of a swimming pool, which is like a crazy thing to think about. You know, it goes from the worst incident of your life to something that completely changes the course of your life for the better. And yeah, I'm really humbled that we've got to do that. We've met some incredible people along the way that have helped us on this journey. You know, we obviously haven't done it by ourselves, from the doctors, the surgeon, the physios, all the way through to, I mean, you know, Bev as well.
Yes.
You know, she's been an instrumental part of our journey, but our friends, our family, and now the people involved with the charity, and loads of people we would have never met too. You know, we were operating in these small bubbles, and now we get to meet great people all the time. Like yourself, Holly, you know, it's just like these things open up as a result of what you think is a bad thing. So it kind of reframes like, what is good or bad? Like, things just happen, and then it's up to you to make what you can of it off the back of it.
Gosh, you're extraordinary people. Absolutely extraordinary. You're touching so many lives. You know, gosh, where will you be in 5-10 years time? What would you have achieved? And we're coming to the end of this podcast now. And I just wanted to ask, we use the analogy of a roller coaster, and sort of, we've talked about the journey a lot in this podcast. Can I ask you both what you would say has been your biggest low on this journey? If I start with you, Ed?
It would seem obvious, but I'd have to say it was waking up in intensive care and contemplating what I'd done to the people around me, not myself. I think that was a really tough period. I think I've been very fortunate in my life to have never experienced, up until that point, sort of really dark suicidal thoughts, you know, and to actually go to a place where you're like, people would be better off without me. To have gone there was the lowest point of my life. But really, what it has given me is an absolute appreciation for how lucky I am to be alive and not be in that position anymore. So actually, it turned out to be a positive thing, but in the moment, about as low as it gets.
Yeah, I can only imagine. Well, I just literally can't. I'm trying to empathise. And Lois?
I'd say probably just before I had that conversation with Ed, I probably just felt really withdrawn. And I probably didn't realise it so much at the time, but when I look back at myself then and how much more I've got now compared to then, I think I can see that. But yeah, just not knowing what the future would hold for that brief period now, it just seems crazy that I was even thinking that, because we've gone on to do so much.
And Lois, conversely, the wind in your gorgeous hair, would it be mountain wind? What would be your high?
Qualifying as a life coach came at a very similar time that we got charitable status. And I just had this realization that I had already come so far. I've always had this weird thing of not thinking that I'm intelligent enough to do things, or like that self-belief piece with business. And I suddenly had that realization that actually I could do this. And that I think through the life coaching, I realized that I was limiting myself. Like, all this comes out when you do the training. And I was like, actually, I can do all of this. And then the limits were off. And I think I had that moment where I was like, wow, okay, this is going to be exciting life.
Oh, and Ed, for yourself on that high?
There is so many. I mean, I still obviously think back to the wiggling toe, because that was the thing that changed everything. And I think in terms of like a shot of, you know, endorphins, that was probably the highest moment. But standing on top of Snowdon with that turning point of looking around me and seeing everyone that helped me get to that point and being in a position I never thought I'd be in again. Walking down the aisle with Lois. I know I'm cheating here. I'm saying loads of different highs. But I mean, it's amazing that there are all these poignant moments, and there continue to be more highs. And I like to live life thinking that maybe the highest bit hasn't come yet, you know, and I'm not going chasing them. I mean, Lois might argue with that, because I keep climbing mountains. But that's a literal high, not metaphorical one. But life's good. And I think we found that formula to take the pressure off ourselves in terms of those hard set goals of where we're going, and lean back more into our values and following our gut more than our heads sometimes, you know, necessarily. And life is unfolding in lots of different ways. And you said it'd be interesting to see where you're in 5 or 10 years time. And people ask me that question, like, what are you doing in 5 years? I'm like, I have no idea. Yeah. I know the charity will still be there as the one constant, but I could never have called getting to this point in the first place. I would never have called any of those highs along the way. So I'm just looking forward to seeing what comes. So I've completely avoided your question there, haven't I?
No, not at all. I mean, it's just, when I said that about 5 to 10, that's what I meant. It feels like you're trusting the universe with the choices that you've made, and you're leaning back into it, and you're letting the wind sort of pick you up and take you places. That's just the most beautiful. I can just so picture that. And we're now at that point, Lois, if I could ask, I've asked you both to write a letter to your younger selves. Have you read it to each other yet?
Briefly last night on the train, didn't we?
Yeah. Lois is a bit better than mine. And longer.
It's always the way with couples, whether they do tell each other or don't tell each other. But Lois, I would love to start with you, if that would be okay. And thank you so much for sharing a part of your soul with us today.
Thank you so much for having us. It was great, great chats. Dear Lois, wow. If I could bottle up everything you're going to do and see, your jaw would hit the floor. Mum and Dad have given you a childhood so full of laughter, love and possibilities, and you're already grabbing onto every single one. There's a fire in your belly that wants to take hold of every one of them, and that fire will keep on burning. Right now, netball might feel like the centre of the universe, and I know it's hard when you don't make the team, but it's okay. The things netball teach you, teamwork, resilience, grit, are going to come in handy in ways you can't yet see. Trust me, every time you get back up, you're becoming the Lois who can take on the world. I know it can be hard to understand who you are and where you fit in, but the best thing you can do is just be yourself. You're going to be loved for being you, so lean into that. Believe in yourself a little more. And by the way, just because you got a C in GCSE maths doesn't mean you're not intelligent. You've got more determination and logic than most, and what really matters is what you do with it, and you do a lot. Your kindness and love for people will be huge assets, so stay curious and open and you will get so much reward. Around age 18, get ready to be swept off your feet by someone who shows up when you least expect it, with a kebab and a can of Stella in hand. Yes. You'll be strong for each other and he will cheer you on and be there in all the ups and downs. It won't always be the fairy tale you pictured, but in the end, it will be even better. So take a deep breath, dive into life. Don't dive into any swimming pools, or maybe do. And remember, this is only the beginning of a fantastic adventure.
Thank you so much, Lois. Thank you. And Ed, over to you.
Dear Ed, I know that rugby feels like everything right now, but it doesn't define you. Who you are as a person and the values you hold make you who you are. Don't let anything or anyone take those away from you. Challenges are coming your way and things are going to get tough, but don't be scared, as those challenges will ultimately lay the foundations for a life that right now you can't even imagine. Be authentic, be kind, work hard, take risks and have fun. Never forget who you are and always be grateful for the things you have. Life is an adventure. Get out there and enjoy it. And then in brackets, you're going to meet a ballerina called Lois. Marry her.
You know, it's just extraordinary when you think about that, those 18-year-olds and the 20-year-old meeting and that one moment in time. And now all that you've been through, the low, you've been through things that, you know, people could be married for 50, 60 years and they've never even touched the sides of where you've travelled. And yet you still are hand in hand and you're still dreaming of your future and you don't know where it's going to take, but as long as you're together. And you can feel that through both of you, and that your love has just been such a healer on what has been the most extraordinary story and life so far. And I wish you both so much. People are very, very lucky that you're there to empathise and to literally show them the way. And anything I can do to help your charity, please do let me know. But thank you for today and your story. Thank you both.
Thank you, Holly.
Thank you, Holly.
Thank you for joining me today. If you've enjoyed this episode, can I ask that you share it with a friend and like, subscribe and review it too, so that together we can inspire even more people to follow their dreams to build a life they love.